I am Dr. Andrew Graves. I have a PhD in English literature from the University of Oregon, where I studied 19th century Gothic fiction. And I am an educator, a writer, a games enthusiast, an avid reader, and I am here to talk about the Gothic tradition and how Dracula fits therein.
All right, now bust out a freestyle rap about Dracula for me.
Oh yeah, that's totally in my skill set. That's the thing that's gonna happen.
That's not in your wheelhouse?
It's not in my wheelhouse. I can't beatbox, man.
I'm Bram Stoker, and I'm here to say I love Dracula the crazy way. I'm kidding.
We can jump back into the discussion of literature. So, the Gothic tradition gets started in 1764
Ooh.
With the Castle of Otranto by Horace Walpole. The Gothic tradition is unique in literature for having a definitive and concrete starting point.
Uh-huh.
With a lot of literature, we're sort of like, it kind of started around here. There's a lot of debate about what counts. But with Gothic literature, it gets started with the Castle of Otranto because Horace Walpole called it a Gothic novel or a Gothic romance in a way that no one else had really self-labeled like that. And the Gothic tradition is notable for its historiographic function.
Okay.
And this is a theory I subscribe to that was introduced by Robert Migdal. And the idea is that Gothic literature will set up a distinction between the past and the present, usually in an effort to portray the present as more enlightened.
All right.
So Gothic novels were written by British authors in the 18th century and in the 19th century, and they were usually set in Europe, they were set in France or Italy, and they were set in the past. So characters were portrayed as superstitious, they were portrayed as unreasonable or barbaric, in contrast to the presumably enlightened British audience.
Okay.
And so this is going on during the sort of revolution of reason and science that occurs throughout the 18th and 19th centuries. So readers in Britain could hypothetically read Gothic novels and feel very superior to all of the sort of backwards or barbaric characters that they were reading about.
Gotcha.
So even the protagonists with whom the British readers would presumably sympathize, those characters were often portrayed as possessing more enlightened or reasonable traits, even though they were Catholic, and I'll have to get into the Catholic-Protestant thing in a second, they often seemed more Protestant. They seemed more British. But it was important still that they were French or that they were Italian because it justified their superstitions.
Okay.
That they could really believe that there were ghosts or spirits or supernatural signs that the British were not supposed to believe in at this point. And so within this context, so Horace Walpole, jumping back there to 1764,
sure,
he originally publishes The Castle of Otranto pretending to be its translator.
Oh.
And he writes a fictitious foreword,
okay,
in which he says, I have published this manuscript that was written by a Catholic monk hundreds of years ago.
Okay.
And he says this to justify all of the weird supernatural things in the novel. That he's like, we know none of these things are real, but the Italian audience for this text might have believed they were real. In this case, what we're looking at is on a massive scale, the goal is really to make the people who don't believe in these things,
sure,
feel better about themselves.
Oh, okay, I gotcha.
Right, so it's like, hey, you wonderful, enlightened British audience, you are so smart, right? Because that's not a bad way to push novels either. So he originally publishes it pretending to be the translator. It's very successful. He comes out with a second edition in which he admits to being the author, and that's where he kind of defines the concept of the Gothic novel as something that he says will combine both the new and old form of romance and what he means by that is you had old romances like the stories of King Arthur.
Sure.
They're kind of exciting, a lot of things happen, but the characters don't feel superhuman.
You bet.
And in contrast, you have the advent of the novel earlier in the 18th century, and these characters feel very human. They're writing about everyday experiences, they're telling us about their feelings, we really get their perspective. And so what he wanted was to have stories in which extraordinary things happen to normal people. People who have feelings, who have a first-person experience, who can, you know, most of the time run away in terror, right? Like, it's not like one of the Knights of the Round Table who encounters some kind of extraordinary challenge and is eager to rise to it. It's like the wayward princess in the castle who's just really terrified of the crazy guy trying to marry her.
Okay.
That's where the Gothic gets started. And then the Gothic becomes very popular, especially toward the end of the 18th century, with Anne Radcliffe, who invents the Scooby-Doo ending.
Okay.
Or what is known as the explained supernatural. So Horace Walpole actually had an enormous statue that is animated and moves around. And Anne Radcliffe has characters who think they see supernatural things. Like, I thought I saw a ghost. And then at the end of the novel, we find out it wasn't a ghost. It was a pirate in a bedsheet.
That sounds like a double Johnny Quest ending. It's like, not only was it a pirate, but it was a pirate in a bedsheet pretending to be a ghost. It was a ghost pirate. It was a pirate ghost.
All I can say is your Johnny Quest writers knew their Anne Radcliffe, right?
Oh my God, yeah. No, definitely.
So this had the advantage of continuing to portray Southern European and Catholic characters as superstitious, in contrast to their British readers. And it continued to give the British readers the thrill of imagining these extraordinary, supernatural, haunting occasions. But at the end of the novel, they could be reassured that reason would win out in the end, that there was an explanation. That takes us into the 19th century. Gothic literature fades a bit as its own category, and instead we see Gothic influences among a lot of writers throughout the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
We see it in the works of the Brontes.
Yeah.
We see it in some of Dickens' novels. Elizabeth Gaskell writes short stories in the Gothic vein. And when these writers draw on the Gothic tradition, they don't tend to write full-fledged Gothic novels where characters are haunted by things they can't explain and they have to run away from ghosts in castles. They tend to write novels where tropes of Gothic fiction appear at certain times. So in Jane Eyre, Jane is haunted by a figure in Thornfield, and it turns out that that figure is Mr. Rochester's wife, Bertha.
How did I know you were going to talk about Jane Eyre?
I mean, because I've never had a conversation about literature in which I didn't mention Jane Eyre.
I have a question for you about the Brontes.
Yes, go for it.
How much grave water do you think they drank in their childhood?
I mean, they all died young.
I think they drank all the grave water.
All the grave water. The supernatural returns to Gothic literature in a big way. So,
ooh.
Gothic literature started with the supernatural, then we got the explained supernatural, and then throughout the mid-19th century, everything was very psychological.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the 19th century, we start getting real monsters.
Oh.
So we have Mr. Hyde in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. We have the Beetle, Great God Pan. We have Carmilla, Dracula. Where we have creatures who are undeniably not human. They don't obey the properties of physics. They live too long, or their physical features are strange. And this is largely understood as a reaction to the scientific discussions of deep time and evolution. This has disrupted British society, world, to really think about human life in a new way. And with Dracula in particular, it actually fits into that more traditional vein of Gothic literature, because what we learn is that Dracula is old. He is 400 years old. He thinks like someone from 400 years ago. We get in that with Dracula's age. Dracula comes to represent the past again, in contrast to a presumed enlightened British reader.
Okay.
And the enlightened British reader can empathize or sympathize with a host of characters we have for our protagonists. And one of the things that's really interesting about Dracula is who those protagonists are. Though in early Gothic fiction, our protagonists are usually some kind of impoverished gentry.
Okay.
You know? They are ladies, but not ladies with a lot of money. And that's how they end up in these perilous situations. So Dracula has a new set of protagonists. And
okay.
It's a similar set of protagonists to what we see in other Gothic-related fiction of the late 19th century, which is that they are professionals in a variety of new fields of expertise.
Uh-huh.
So we have an alienist, what we would now think of as a psychologist or a psychiatrist. We have a medical doctor. We have a real estate clerk. We have in Mina a woman who is learning the skills associated with administrative, secretarial work, but also kind of journalist work.
Okay.
And we have the one rich guy. There's also the one rich guy.
Okay.
And the American. His profession is to be an American. But that's okay, because he's good with a gun, so he's an American.
Yeah, no.
And so this is different from previous Gothic literature, where characters were these very amateur sleuths. Like, they had to solve mysteries, they had to figure a thing out in order to survive, but they didn't have training, they didn't have skills. These characters have training, they have skills, they have this expertise, and that's part of this historiographic function.
Okay.
We're seeing what is valued in British society in the late 19th century, and part of what's valued is formal training in intellectual pursuits, in a way that we hadn't seen that as a value in the past. There's also an interesting wrinkle in terms of this historiographic function of Gothic literature when we look at Dracula, that in the past, British authors were really putting themselves in contrast to Catholicism. There was a lot of Protestantism versus Catholicism, with the idea that Protestantism was going to embrace enlightenment and reason, and Catholicism was trapped in superstition.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, Dracula is written by Bram Stoker, who is Irish, who is Catholic.
Yes.
And arguably the most effective character in Dracula is Van Helsing.
Yes.
Who is also Catholic. And notably, he's also the most superstitious of the protagonists.
And of
he's
Dutch
the one,
descent.
He's the one who comes in and tells them about the vampire.
Yeah.
Because he believes in the vampire.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he's right. I mean, the vampire's there, and the vampire exists, and his knowledge of the vampire is crucial.
I mean, he's Peter Cushing. He knows. Yeah, no, don't trust Van Helsing on a Death Star.
Van Helsing's role, like, to embrace some superstition is interesting because he's still a scientist.
Mm-hmm,
he's still
mm-hmm.
a doctor.
Yeah.
You know, he is the mentor to one of our British doctors.
Sure.
So he kind of brings these things together. He brings, like, a little bit of superstition to the table, but insists on implying reason. He's like, our normal reason isn't working. Here's some hypothesis grounded in superstition, but we're still going to test it scientifically. And instead, our most superstitious character in Dracula is, of course, Dracula.
Yes.
And he's the one, Dracula's the one, who thinks he can't, like, just enter a room without being invited.
Okay.
You know, Dracula is the one who believes that a cross has the power to fend him off.
Okay.
So, Dracula actually becomes, then, that image of the superstitious past, where Van Helsing is the image of a very, like, open-minded present. Like, we have to accept all possible theories and test them. Dracula doesn't really test theories. Dracula, like, just believes random things. He's like, I've got to sleep on my own soil or I'm gonna die. Like, he didn't test that, you know? He just believes it. But the protagonists ultimately win because they understand his superstitions. Like, they hunt down his soil. You know, they expose him to crosses. They take advantage of his nocturnal habits. Like, they accept that he believes his superstitions, and they use that against him. And so in that way, they are these, like, eminently modern characters.
Okay.
And people are oftentimes sort of surprised by how uneventful much of the novel is. Like, this is one of the most popular novels in history. Dracula has more adaptations than any character except possibly Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
And those two are just, like, constantly in a race with each other. And so when you actually get someone to sit down and read Dracula, they're like, wait a second. There's, like, 100 pages here where these guys are just, like, sitting around filing documents. Yeah, so one of the primary actions that the characters in Dracula take is to collect the text of Dracula. That what they're really doing throughout the novel is they're looking at their own records. They're looking at the information they've collected, the things they've written down or recorded, and finding in those evidence about Dracula.
Okay.
And so they come to start modeling, like, a certain version of the scientific method. Like, we've collected a bunch of information, now let's make a hypothesis and let's look at that information and see what kind of evidence we find.
Okay.
And it does occasionally leave modern readers a little bewildered about, like, but wait, wasn't there supposed to be a vampire?
Like, yeah.
Shouldn't we be fighting the vampire? Why are we sitting around in the living room talking about documents? That format in which it's written works really well to highlight how the novel is in part about the contemporary science of the late 19th century, where science is becoming a profession for the first time. In the past, science has largely been an amateur endeavor. Like, wealthy people go out and collect fossils. And now science is being trained in universities. Scientific knowledge is being shared across international boundaries. And so Dracula has characters who will get information from the newspaper. They'll get information from lower class individuals, and they'll have to kind of translate it into data.
So it's almost like the characters from Dracula are almost like what we'll think of as PCs in the future for, like, RPGs and video games.
Yeah, they have to, like, solve that mystery in using new resources and new tools. And if we think about, like, PCs in video games, are oftentimes, or PCs in RPGs, are being played by characters who use modern logic, but they're oftentimes in, like, some kind of non-modern setting. And so very much that kind of thing. Like, if your Dungeons and Dragons crew is like, I have figured out the mystery by applying the scientific method, and now I know how to defeat the vampire.
Yeah.
It's a thing that can happen in D&D. Like, it is very much like that. It's really the difference between how you imagine a role-playing quest occurring mm-hmm. and what it looks like at the table.
Okay.
And D&D, or the Dracula, actually looks like the table talk. And so it's punctuated by those moments of action that you get in a role-playing game.
Mm-hmm.
But the bulk of the text is kind of like the characters talking about what they're going to do.
Okay.
You know, but wait, if we check page 134 and look at the grapple rules, I have a really clear idea of how I could defeat that orc. You know, like, that's what you're reading instead of reading about the fight with the orc. It's time, it's Mina's turn. She's out of the room, being attacked by Dracula.
Well, if you're not in the room, you're being attacked by Dracula. Where are the chips at? I'm hungry. Okay, all right. Nina's being attacked by Dracula while we're out doing stuff. So, all right. That's what's going on, you guys.
Wait, what does my character know again? Aren't I in the room? Parker, you're asleep. You don't know what's happening. Quit trying to say you know what's happening. No, your character hasn't woken up yet.
When the shit is Renfield gonna come back and play his character? I'm really pissed off about that. Now he's just, like, hanging out at Dracula's place all the goddamn time because he has to work late shifts and doesn't want to show up.
Man, never split the party.
No. Now he's just, like, the DM's character and he just, like, is controlled by the DM. It's so stupid.
Just says crazy stuff all the time.
Just fucking worthless.
When did he get so obsessed with the blood?
Dracula feels like the D&D game that went wrong.
It really does, yeah. Like, it feels like, you know, Lucy seemed like she was going to be a character in there, but, like, she was really, you know, just dating one of the other players. And
was there for, like, two sessions, and it's like, okay, well, we still got to use her.
Yeah. So she's gonna die.
Yeah.
You know. And then, like, half the characters always want to do one thing, and the other half want to do another thing.
Split the party.
Yeah, okay, so you guys are over here, and you're doing this thing, and we'll talk to you for the next 2 hours. But then I gotta really get back to the other players and talk about what's going on with them. Yeah, no, I mean, it's a really dysfunctional role-playing game. They all remembered the really great parts. Like, a year later, they weren't like, did we really spend 8 hours arguing about whether or not you could actually get up to that castle in 2 hours to get the soil? Instead, they're like, oh man, remember that time we attacked the vampire and we cut him, but, like, bags of gold spilled open? Like, that was awesome. It was like he was bleeding money. Yeah, Dracula definitely has very little moral complexity in its explicit text.
I mean, yeah.
Definitely there have been plenty of analyses that have challenged, you know, the moral righteousness of the protagonists in the novel. The Dracula protagonists aren't just British, right? Like,
yeah.
We've got a Dutchman, we've got an American, like, there's a lot of scholarship about that kind of multinational coalition.
Sure.
Where Dracula can't work with others.
Uh-huh.
He can dominate others, but he can't work with others. Gail Turley Houston wrote about Dracula as a competition between, like, financial entities.
Okay.
So she wrote about it in the context of the various economic scares of the late 19th century. And that's where, like, Dracula bleeding money is really important. Like, we cut him and what spills out is gold coins. But that idea then that the protagonists represent Western coalition in comparison to Dracula's sort of Eastern monopoly.
Okay.
It seems like they kind of need to work together, but there's definitely a line somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you go too far east and the racism kicks in.
Okay.
But it's not the Dutch. The Dutch are fine.
That's where Bram Stoker and Lovecraft differ.
Yeah. Bram Stoker, less racist than Lovecraft.
Shit.
Not a great accomplishment.
Yeah. Don't trust Van Helsing out of Death Star.
Don't trust Van Helsing.
He'll steer you wrong. I mean, he's great for, like, you know, governing local systems, but no, because he'll be, like...
Evacuate? In our moment of triumph?
Yes.
Let's see, what else do you want to know about Dracula?
Well, can you tell me about Dracula? What do you think people should know about Dracula? In your mind, in your mind canon, how do you defeat Dracula? What is Dracula? What are vampires in your mind canon?
In my mind canon, what are vampires and how do you defeat Dracula? I think that the key to defeating Dracula is to, like, pay attention. Like, everything that goes wrong with characters in Dracula happens because, like, everybody has this faith in the sort of domestic security.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we could look at this. Here's something that's important about Dracula, is to look at the characters who suffer are the characters at the lower end of social privilege.
Okay.
So they are women, or they are poor, or they are not in, like, a majority group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Renfield is exploited for his mental status.
Okay.
Lucy and Mina are attacked and they're women.
Mm-hmm.
We find out that these poor children are attacked when Lucy becomes a vampire. They're attacked by Lucy. So the characters who are attacked are not, like, privileged, wealthy men.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because no one is paying attention to the characters who are attacked. Like, no one is taking them seriously. When they, you know, when Lucy talks about what she sees, everybody thinks it's just, like, a bad dream.
Okay.
You know? Mina is sort of excluded from these discussions that the men are having, and then she ends up getting, like, attacked, like, seriously, while they're in the other room having these discussions.
Yeah.
So there's this consistent trend that, like, if you were just paying attention, if you were just, like, listening to the children, if you were listening to the women, if you were listening to the people who are suffering from mental disorders, like, mm-hmm. none of this would happen.
Yeah.
Like, all of the attacks are grounded in this social exploitation that is already occurring.
Mm-hmm.
That just makes it easier for someone like Dracula to come in. I mean, beyond that, like, you know, we don't really need to get into the, like, RPG stats of, like, what weapon do we use to defeat Dracula? Like, whatever. He's kind of strong, he's kind of tough, but he's clearly attacking vulnerable people because he is not himself, like, invulnerable or unstoppable. You know, every time he gets in a confrontation with a group of armed, able-bodied men, you know, he runs away.
Yeah.
That's his go-to move.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, there's some people here, they found me. I will run away. You know, so as long as you're not, like, letting him attack people, you're fine.
So you're saying he's an awesome villain.
He is a great villain. I mean, there is no denying that Dracula is one of the great villains of history.
And like, you know, myself personally, I love awesome villains. Not as, like, a person who, like, loves evil. I'm a theatrical person who's like, I think this character is amazing. Godspeed, Starscream, or as an example.
And I mean, like, if we want to talk about Dracula as a prototype for the concept of a supervillain,
which I do.
The diabolical plan. He has spent years researching British real estate.
Yes.
He has taught himself English.
Yes.
He thinks ahead enough to summon a real estate agent. I mean, that's where our novel gets started, right? Is with Jonathan Harker coming to Castle Dracula to consult Dracula on purchasing plots of land.
Exactly.
Because Dracula knows he needs to have a couple different bases so that when he invades England, and I mean, he invades England by himself, and he's got a plan that, like, could work, because he can bounce from property to property, and he's sort of impressed with how easy the English have made it.
Sure.
Because he's coming from this more medieval mindset of conquest where you gotta like kill a bunch of people to have a plot of land.
Yeah.
And he's like, but I can just buy it and then I can just go there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mine.
Yes.
And I mean, that's, you know, part of the incentive for invading London.
And think about how horrific that would be to the Londoner to think about, like, what if Genghis Khan could just, like, take his wealth and move into our neighborhood?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
This is about the gentle conqueror. This is about the Eastern European gaining enough money to move to London.
Yep. That's why, Ben, the novel has to show us how our coalition of Western forces...
Oh, sure, even including some Americans.
I know. And again, what's his profession? Being American.
Exactly.
But they are able to repel him.
Sure.
But the threat is there, you know, and it's this sort of dual-edged sword of an open society.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you could certainly argue, as many have, as I have, that there is definitely something regressive about the novel.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I mean, gender politics aside, because the novel is massively regressive in terms of gender politics.
Yeah.
But in its sort of anxiety about an open society, even though the novel does give us a coalition, it's not just British, it certainly seems to say, but also immigrants are scary. That's not so great, Bram.
Yeah.
Also, say, wealthy British people are scary, as we've learned through the rest of British fiction.
Or history, I mean.
Yeah. I've only read novels. I assume history is mostly a terrifying illusion that we're all trying to ignore.
It's all, you know, it's all simulation anyway.
That's right. That's the only explanation.
All right, so if we're gonna wrap up Dracula, what's the go-to that people should walk away with from Dracula?
So the most important thing to know about Dracula, the thing that I would want readers to know as they approach Dracula, is that the headnote, the unnamed headnote that says, how these papers have been arranged shall be made clear in the reading of them.
Okay.
Is actually the most important page in the novel.
Really?
And that it's easy to ignore. You know, it's before chapter one. So if you're just going to chapter one, you don't even see it. We don't know who wrote that headnote in a way that all of the other sections of the novel are associated with the characters who wrote them. You know, whether it's Harker's letters to Mina, or Mina's journals, or Dr. Seward's recordings, we always know who said what.
Exactly.
But we have this head note that is unauthored. It's just there.
Nice.
And it's there very much in this mode of scientific writing.
Okay.
That a scientific paper, when we read it, rarely says I. Like, I did this thing. It's always this thing was done. How these papers have been arranged. We don't know who arranged them, but they have been arranged.
Sure.
And that sets the tone for the novel. It tells us we're going to get information out of order. That we will be given information in a chronological order that the characters themselves didn't see in that order. So there's always a disjuncture between the characters' experiences and the reader's experiences.
Okay.
And if you pay attention to that headnote, the whole novel makes more sense.
Okay. I have one final question for you.
Yes.
Most favorite character in Dracula, least favorite character in Dracula?
I mean, most favorite character in Dracula, like, I'm going to go with Dracula.
Yeah, I mean, that's
Dracula's
like...
Dracula's the most interesting.
Sure.
Least favorite character in Dracula... I am going to go with Arthur Holmwood.
Okay.
Because he's the boring one who's only there because he's rich.
Okay. Okay.
Right? Like, Tony Stark at least has, you know, like, virtue of being a genius, too.
Sure.
Arthur Holmwood, just rich.
Okay. Okay.
Everyone else has some kind of training. Everyone else has some kind of skill to contribute. Arthur just pays for everything. Like, as they go around the table and all of the characters say what they're gonna do, you know, and Seward's like, I'm gonna go interview that guy. And Mina's like, I'm gonna collect all of our papers and type them up. And Van Helsing's like, I'm gonna give you all the crucial information. And Holmwood's like, I'll pay for it. I got it. And yet, like, he also becomes this kind of focal point. He is the one who was engaged to Lucy in the end. Like, he was her fiancé.
Sure.
And he is the one who drives the stake through her heart in this incredibly, like, disturbing scene of three men putting down that unruly woman.
Yeah.
So he...
That's a little bit gothic.
Yeah, but he is our like, patriarchal figure... come to life.
Okay.
And if he wasn't there, it'd be so much easier to, like, look for some kind of social virtue in the novel.
Okay.
So there you go.
All right. So I'm going to ask you a question that's kind of akin to, like, I once asked Ken Haidt, what would happen if you applied an elder sign to a vampire? And he's like, not a goddamn thing. And, what would happen if, like, based off of your background, what would happen if Dracula showed up at one of those parties over in over at the Great Gatsby's house? What happens if Dracula shows up at Great Gatsby's, and if he, like, maybe put the moves on Daisy or? Decide, like, what would happen if Dracula showed up in the world of Greg Gatsby? Would he, like, team up with Tom? Would he team up with the Gats?
I mean, I think it's important to note that Dracula fundamentally can't team up with anyone.
Okay.
Right? Like, psychologically, he's incapable of teaming up with anyone. So what would happen is that Dracula would show up at the party and start to pick off the more vulnerable members of the party.
Well, there goes Clip Springer.
I know.
Clip Springer's your new, what you call him?
Renfield.
Yeah, yeah, Clip Springer's right. Your Renfield.
And then, you know, the, say, like, drunk woman in the yellow dress, like she's a vampire now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and
there's a bunch of people partying above a gas station who are now vampires.
Yeah. and the important thing is that, like, you could really see Dracula actually being more successful.
Valley of Ashes.
In, like, East and West Egg.
Sure.
Than he was in Britain.
Yeah.
Because if what makes him successful is, like, nobody paying attention. Like, ain't nobody paying attention in Gatsby. That's the whole... Like, oh, yeah. We've been having an affair forever. You know, like, nobody's paying attention.
All right.
Thank you again, Drew, for talking to us about Dracula